Warning, this episode contains expletives. Hello and welcome to Planet Poetry. I'm Robin Houghton.
And I'm Peter Kenny. And today we're thinking about colonialism and reconciliation. We've got a cracking interview with Inua Ellams discussing his brilliant collection, The Actual.
And Peter delves into the French negritude movement of the mid-20th century. Plus, of course, is today's thorny issue.
But first, let's hear Robin's interview with Inua Ellams.
Nigeria in 1984, Inua Ellams is an internationally touring poet, playwright, performer, graphic artist and designer. He is an ambassador for the Ministry of Stories and his published books of poetry include Candy Coated Unicorns and Converse All Stars, 13 Fairy Negro Tales, The Wire-Headed Heathen and The Half God of Rainfall, an epic story set in verse. His first play, The 14th Tale, was awarded a Fringe First at the Edinburgh International Theatre Festival, and his fourth, Barbershop Chronicles, sold out two runs at England's National Theatre. In 2020, his first full poetry collection, The Actual, was published by Penned in the Margins. Inua Ellams, welcome to Planet Poetry.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
I'm quite excited about this because I've read a number of the poems from your collection, The Actual, from Penned in the Margins, in various magazines of the last year or two. And so when I heard that it was coming out as a collection, I actually pre-ordered it.
Oh, wow.
I know. I rarely do that. So I hope you're feeling privileged there.
I really am. I am. Thank you.
And when it came, I wasn't disappointed. In fact, I was looking at your website at the range of work that you've done, and it seems amazing. This is your first full collection, but you've written plays and pamphlets, and you've done all kinds of work, haven't you? So
yeah, I've done a fair few things and a fair few more things coming out, but this is my first full collection. I guess I didn't want to rush it. For me, publishing a book, the book can't be the end product, and it can't be its sake. It can't be for its own thing, or even writing poems. I write various poems in various ways, but for the book, I just wanted it to feel like it was worthy of being collected, of being owned. And it wasn't just the poems here and there. And it wasn't, you know, so I wanted to create a piece of work that was self-referential, that kind of stands on its own. And I started working on the fuck poems. And even then it was purely just expression and anger and frustration, me vomiting into my phone. And I never considered it a book until I realized there was a pattern, there was a sequence, there was a methodology through which all the poems were born. And then it became a book. I don't actually know if I'm ever going to write another collection of poems. I think I might just keep on. Yeah, so this might be the one and only.
Stop when you're ahead. But that is fascinating to hear. I want to ask you a bit more about how you put it together, because it's not a sequence as such, but clearly it's linked by every poem. We've already told our audience there's an R rating here. Every poem has the same format of title, like fuck /
apologies.
Name.
Yeah.
So, but there is actually a sequence towards the end of the book, isn't there, which I'll ask you about shortly.
Yeah.
One of your themes is to do with boys growing up, what influences their development, what they have to deal with, how their lives can be ruined even. And this is clearly one of the issues that you're angry about, in the sense that there is a lot of anger in this book, as you've mentioned.
Well, I mean, I think the poems initially were born from anger, or rather places for anger. And in the attempt to create art and to write the poem and to engage with the topic, anger morphed into something more contemplative, more sincere. And that is how all the poems are sort of structured.
I thought maybe as an opener, you might read the poem Fuck Perseus, which perhaps introduces this idea.
Yeah, which is on page 24 of the book, to anyone who's listening who has a copy. Fuck Perseus. Regarding the claim some women enable sexual predators, consider power structures Consider Mount Olympus, a gleaming symbol of aspiration, of masculinity so toxic. When Poseidon raped the mortal maiden Medusa in Athena's smaller temple, Athena cursed its defilement, blamed Medusa, turned her scaly-skinned, snake-headed of such ugliness to see her was to freeze the blood to stone. Then Perseus comes along, all swashbuckling bastard, all gleaming shielded schmuck, to slay her, slice her, spear her swirling skull. And all the men cheered, and Poseidon stayed silent, his crime forgotten when Perseus won. And story by story, myth by myth, urban legend by urban legend, locker room talk by locker room talk, men make other men.
I love the way you have so much sound play and alliteration, that phrase, gleaming shielded schmuck. And I liked what you said about maybe things start from anger, but you wanted to create a work of art. And I felt that that theme of the locker room talk has this ominous ring about it. And later on, though, we have a version of male talk in a barber's, which is a very different thing altogether. The poem Fuck Carrots, and I loved it not just for its humour, but you somehow create these very vivid characters. And I felt like I was watching a movie. And I just wondered if that's... Does that come from your playwriting experience?
Yeah, definitely comes from the playwriting background, but also the screenwriting background, which is another of my disciplines. I'm working on television series and feature films at the moment. Uh-huh. So understanding how to lead the viewer's eye through a room, how to create character and moments and presence out of nothing is really coming to the fore in my work right now. And trying to create that dance, that sense of community and that singularity of space in Fuck Carrots was really close to my intentions when I was writing that poem. Yeah. And going back to the things you pointed out for Fuck Perseus, I was trying to create that sleazy slow motion scene when the bad boy hero walks into the bar with gleaming guns and swords, etc. So I was using a great alliteration definitely to slow down time, but also create that sleek, gratuitous smoothness which is used to glaze and decorate so many of our action heroes. I was, you know, very conscious of that.
Yeah.
And locker room talk was one of the phrases Donald Trump used to justify the layered sort of the layering comments he made about women. So I was just trying to, to tap into those worlds a bit.
Yeah, and we have some other movie references later, don't we? Jack Nicholson and Batman and other sort of heroic characters in that way. I like the way you started off with the Greeks and kind of
move all the way to contemporary mythology, yeah.
Could we hear, I know it's one of the longer poems, but could we hear Fuck Carrots? Because now we've talked about it, I think.
Absolutely. Let me see. So page 65, yeah. Fuck Carrots. Here we go. Friday night, barbershop, it's starting again. Samuel, his hand poised over Ethan's head, is Basquiat before an uncrowned king, is Henry Moore before a block of wood, is Sigmund Freud before a mass of contradictions. Clippers, paintbrush, chisel, voice, the task is the same, to bring to light what lies within. The shop is stock full of us, our skin, all the tints and tones of wood, our heads of wild foliage. Kwame, just taxied from Saudi Arabia, slides off his cap, says his driver was a woman. How progressive London is compared to Saudi Arabia, which banned them from driving. Why, Ethan asks, wide-eyed beneath Samuel. Because, Kwame says, fear of infidelity. They even ban courgettes. Cucumbers are illegal. Emmanuel, who knows where this is going, he who owns the shop, who's heard all types of talk, sighs into his client's head. Why, Ethan asks, because of self-pleasure, Winston cackles from the center of the shop. Because of vegetables, they won't need a man. What about carrots, asks Uncle Sinsue. Ah, too pointy, Kwame responds. But you can carve them, pipes Hammett from the back. They can be huge. Yes, size matters. And the tides of conversation swells among the men. Some, as if captains, sway in their seats. Others stand up, out on a limb, begging for the sanity and sanctity of sex, covering the sun's ears, risible in the ridicule. A passerby peeking might wonder what it is. If something's in the water, some loosening opiate, a dark tonic, black juice we have drunk, what magic is this welding of loose-necked Pinocchios, gym freaks, thin-limbed immigrants, emigrants, fantastic fools, fathers, sons, rulers, and the ruled, loud in our laughter, silent in our suffering. What is this binding? What is set free? All I know is Ethan's cut is clean. Samuel released what lay within. His mass trimmed, the wood gleams. And though he's one of us, now he's crowned king.
Superb. I love that one. The loose-necked Pinocchios. And this vision of the men, some as if captains, swaying in their seats. You can just see the room all like kind of coming to life. Really, really nice.
Yeah.
The form of these poems, they're all, would you call them prose poems? I'm not sure. You said you wrote them, you spoke them into your phone. They don't actually have line breaks as such, yeah. Do they? But they have these forward slashes, which almost signify line breaks, I guess. Is that the intention?
Well, one of the things is the poems were written, were typed into my phone when I was in the midst of the frenzy of my work, which is multifaceted, and I'm constantly spinning several plates. So when I was writing, I wanted to represent on the page what it felt like to be carrying all of these disparate ideas, trying to weave them. And they would just come out as torrents of words, which I then go back and edit. So I didn't want to use punctuation to try and slow down the process of reading the poems. I just wanted them to be on the page and to invite the reader to decode them. But the hints that I gave in how to read the poem were to use these forward slashes. And they occupy a multitude of spaces. They are commas, they are semicolons, they are full stops, they are line breaks, they are caesuras, they are breaths in the reading. And it's all of these things. And I just wanted the reader to imagine what it might have been like to be in my head and then to figure out the puzzle of the poems that way. So they don't have line breaks as per se, but they do have line breaks, if you know what I mean.
No, I really got that. In fact, I think they were a long way from prose poems, and many of them felt to me almost like sonnets, because you definitely have this kind of turn quite often, like two-thirds of the way into the poem, suddenly things do kind of go in another direction, and that's significant, I felt. There are four found poems in the book. They're called, you label them found poems, and they're rather like mini plays, and they always start with so, and they always end with am I wrong? Without a question mark, which I like. And it's always a male speaker retelling a story. I mean, were these actually found? In what sense are they found? Yeah. Were they conversations you overheard? Or
they are found. So these were conversations or stories that I heard in barbershops.
Oh, okay.
Some of them appear in the play that I wrote a few years ago called Barbershop Chronicles, of which the poem Fuck Carrot is one of those scenes which never made it into the play, but I thought it'd work as a poem. So all of those found poems are some of those conversations from the play. And yeah, so these were stories that men told me or that I overheard. And because I didn't create them as such, I did find them. So I cleaned them up and edited them a little bit and added a little bit more musicality and structure to them. But essentially, I found these were gifted to me as a bystander in barbershops. But the thing is also, particularly in terms of West African attitudes towards storytelling and towards narratives, there's this belief that there is no single truth and there is no single owner of a narrative. When the griot or traveling storyteller performs or entertains the audience, they expect the audience to take the story from them and tell it amongst themselves if they don't do a good enough job holding their attention. So there's this fluency, this sense that no stories are fixed. So what I'm trying to do in asking am I wrong is to invite the reader into that space, mm-hmm. to disagree, to dispute the nature of the story or its ending. So it's also a sort of very Nigerian West African specific oral tradition that I'm trying to riff on there.
Oh, okay. And bringing the reader in, I really like that.
Yeah.
Something that we talked about on Planet Poetry, Peter and myself recently, was whether when you pick up a collection of poetry, whether one reads it from front to back as a sort of almost like you read a novel, or whether you dip in and out. We agreed that poets probably have put poems together in a certain order for a reason. Therefore, there is something to be said for reading in order. And as I did this through the actual, I noticed all kinds of links. Sometimes you group poems in little groups where one word like dust comes up in Fuck Camels, and then it's the title of the next poem. And was this deliberate detail in grouping some of the poems in this way?
Yeah, I think 70-80% of the poems operate that way, where the title of the following poem exists as a word in the preceding poem. And it sort of started organically, where after writing maybe the first half of the book or the first third of the book, I began to see loose patterns. Then I'd structure them, then think of what poem could exist as a link, as a bridge between two poems. And then these themes would begin to come out and I'd find spaces for poems and slot them in. So definitely this, the actual particularly, more so than, I don't know, some of my other pamphlets, I think definitely benefits from reading and looking out for the links between them. And even the opening poems, for instance, the very first poem is called Fuck Tupac. And the second poem is called Fuck Biggie Too. And if you know a little bit about hip hop history, then both of them were rivals. And we're partially, or it is assumed, they were involved in each other's death. Ah. And then the poem after that is called The Mandela Effect, which is a poem that looks at specifically at the deaths of Black men. And the poem after that is called Fuck Mandela. Now, the interesting thing is, when I was looking for a poem to bridge Biggie to Mandela, I Google searched their names in the search bar and came across this thing called the Mandela Effect, which is what the poem goes on to explain, which are these phenomena called collective misremembering, where people assume things have happened that haven't happened yet. But this was quite prevalent within African communities, where they thought Biggie had died when he was still alive, or thought the same thing about Mandela. So that poem was perfect as a bridge to Fuck Mandela. And so there are these subtle links that exist and in the groupings of poems and in the theme and thematically working across poems.
There are some quite explosive poems in the book, I would say. Controversial, maybe.
Potentially.
You're railing against toxic masculinity, but the British Empire, and you were born in Nigeria, and I guess this is at the bottom of a lot of the things you're writing about here. And we've got this one called Fuck Kipling. Now, you know, Kipling is the nation's favourite poet. So, but I think we need to hear that one.
Well, I was a huge fan of Kipling, and I still respect him in some ways as a writer, but Kipling came up with the phrase, the white man's burden, which is to say that in various ways, he legitimized the very idea of white supremacy and of white savior complex, which underpins the various ways in which we here in the West, in America, right across Europe, report on countries in sub-Saharan Africa and in India, et cetera. And that has created a lasting legacy in terms of racism, how it still plays out, across the world. That was what hurt me the most, because I loved Kipling's poem, If, for instance. When I read it as a kid, I wanted to grow up to be the kind of man Kipling described.
Yeah.
But in learning about Kipling and his history, I realized that Kipling would not have seen me as a man in his time. I would have been, as he described, half devil, half child. So I would always have been beneath him. Therefore, I'm not the audience for his work. And he was very clear about that. So I think that gave birth to this poem called Fuck Kipling. It's on page 30, I believe. Fuck Kipling. If I'd been there when he wrote The White Man's Burden, if I'd seen the half-devil, half-child line form in him, if in reaching for his neck I tipped his inkwell, if gallons spilled like black blood across the middle passage, if we fell into it and washed up back on Gold Coast shores, I would spur him inland at gunpoint, find a village in which it's practiced, force Kipling to watch the punishment unfold, where, forsaking execution or confinement, after wrongdoings, the guilty is stood in a large circle before every man, woman, and child who recounts tales of the guilty's good deeds and kindness. 2 days this lasts before the circle is broken to celebration and the accused welcomed back to the tribe. Then I'll lean in to whisper in Kipling's ear before flicking the eager trigger. Such kindness is what we devil child do, and our shit is too good for you. There's something the poem is also riffing on, which is on correctional facilities, how a disproportionate amount of Black people are imprisoned, and how a lot of the time these are capitalist expressions and they make money for huge conglomerate companies here in the UK and particularly in America. These correctional facilities sometimes create more problems for those who leave the facilities. And there are lots of documentaries that goes into various ways, the mental health repercussions, the fact that a lot of things aren't actually available for inmates to better themselves. And yet prisons are seen as great ways of helping members of our communities, the working class communities who fall into bad habits and then, you know, they come out worse. Whereas in pre-colonial Africa, for instance, we didn't have prisons. If people committed crimes, we'd find ways for them to atone for their crimes and welcome back into the community, and then we'd heal together. And despite, you know, these traditions that existed for such a long time, Kipling still viewed us as half devil, having really murky devilish intentions, and being half child, meaning that we didn't have the brain power to compute these really complex ideas of society and how to look after, you know. So those are the things I'm just poking a stick at and trying to undermine in this tongue-in-cheek fantasy of killing Kipling.
But what a powerful way to do it. I mean, I had no idea about what you just talked about there. You know, someone did something wrong, there was ways of getting them to atone and healing together. One doesn't hear stories like that.
Yeah. The thing is, I wasn't even completely aware of this until years ago. An ex-girlfriend, who remains one of the wisest persons I've ever met, she told me that if someone commits a crime, it is as much the fault of the community as it is the person. And I was just too young to understand the concept. But when the Bible says, be your, you know, your brother's keeper, it's riffing on the same thing. You have to look after each other. And if someone is compelled to commit a crime, it's usually out of incredible poverty. And that is because they're hungry. Therefore, we should look after the needs, the things that drive them to crime, as opposed to punish the criminal.
The sequence at the end, you've got this six poem sequence called Fuck Empire, and that was commissioned, wasn't it? What was the story behind that?
It was a 7-part poem, and it was commissioned by the Manchester Literature Festival and the Museum of Manchester, who are in possession of various things, various items, which were claimed by the British government during its colonial period. And one of these was a ceremonial tusk stolen from the city of Benin City. Now, at the time when I was asked to respond to the tusk, I had very strong emotional responses because Benin City is my ancestral home. The artist and the organizer of the festival who asked me to do this didn't know that when they reached out to me. They just said, would you like to write your response? Yeah, they had no clue.
Oh, goodness,
and they said, what do you think? And I said, I have very strong emotions about this, by the way. And if I'm to do this, I will write whatever the hell I want. And they told me, we'd actually want you to do so. Now, Museum of Manchester is one of those very few institutions in the country who are willing to engage with Britain's colonial legacy and are actively trying to return things that were stolen by the colonial government. But currently, it is against British law to return stolen artifacts. So all we can do is write about these things and try and draw attention to them. Now, curiously enough, today is the last day of the punitive expedition, which destroyed Benin City in 1867. And at the time, the entire wall surrounding Benin City and remains to date the longest handmade monument ever in the history of humanity. It took something like 500 years to build a cross-generational wall built with mud and sand, etc., which the British government completely destroyed in 2 weeks. And the sequence of poems just hopes to draw attention to the human rights abuses and the things that were looted. Many of those items exist at the British Museum right now, and many are in private collections scattered across Europe and America.
It does seem to be an endemic issue, doesn't it? I mean, we've all heard of the Elgin marbles for decades now, arguments about those. But I think we've heard less about what's come from the further reaches of the empire, if you like. But, you know, those poems are, it's a powerful sequence. And it's a bit like the Kipling poem, I would say. It's designed to make people feel challenged and uncomfortable, I suppose. Poetry is supposed to do that, isn't it? If you're, especially if you're like me, you're white, middle class, you've, you know, had the typical kind of grammar school education. I'm ignorant of lots of things. I feel like I'm sitting on this mountain of what's gone on in the past. And when some things are drawn to your attention, you can't help but feel, not guilty exactly, but you feel challenged by it. You feel uncomfortable by it. And that has to happen. And maybe poetry is the way it has to happen.
I think it definitely should happen. And I think it's only a problem when you remain with the feeling of guilt and let it overwhelm you rather than see for what it is as an entry point into a conversation, into a series of actions one could take personally or collectively and then move forward. If you stay with guilt, that's just the welcome mat into the conversation. And I think what I tried to do with the sequence of poems is just to say, this happened and it is still happening. And the evidence of it is right here. We can walk in and poke a stick at it and look at it. But how do you feel about this? What do you think should be done? If it were you, what would you want to be done? And then, and just to bring attention to it.
I'd like you to read one of the, what shall I say, lighter themed poems. Because one that jumped out at me straight away towards the beginning called Limp Handshakes.
Yeah.
And I hate those limp handshakes.
It's so disgusting.
And I thought the way you described them was absolutely perfect. So maybe we could hear that one, please.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to read this. It's on page 20 again for those who are listening. And yeah.
Okay.
Fuck limp handshakes. You should do like this. Your four fingers should lift and hold whose hand you grip. You are saying, I got you, your gut, as your thumb completes the lock. You push down as if leaving your thumbprint, as if gifting its tiny terrain of hills and valleys, yourself's singular geography, your soul's surface code for this occasion of meeting. You wait until you feel a response, then lift your eyes to find its accompanying gaze. You hold, you squeeze tighter. Again, you give of your land, give of your fiber. You're saying, remember me as I will you. All through childhood, you practice before a mirror, diligently imagining a truce in civil war, a father reconciling an estranged son, two media moguls merging your worlds. You bring such weight to first handshakes, only to reach out now. And what grasps you back is weak as cooked noodle, limp as warm slug, frail as stale celery. What the actual fuck?
I couldn't put it better myself, that's for sure. I love that. The limp, the celery, the slug. Oh my God.
This is where the book gets its title, The Actual Fuck.
Speaking of which, I love the cover has been very cleverly designed
where
it's got about 10,000 instances of the word fuck that's been very cleverly kind of crossed out in tasteful gold.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously the crossings out has other connotations.
Exactly, to do with censorship, etc. But also the gold is a riff on various things. For instance, West Africa was known as the Gold Coast Shores because during the colonial period and the slavery period, you know, black people were referred to as black gold. And also gold was mined in this area. So it's a riff on all of that and attempts of censorship and deletion from history. But it's also it just looks really good.
It looks really good, doesn't it? And in fact, the end papers also are fantastic.
It's my intention to illustrate all the poems as such. So that's the end papers. The first one is a riff on the very first poem, Fuck Tupac. And there's Tupac you see there. And there are little references to the images conjured in the poem.
Everyone would like to hear one more poem, I think. And there's this sense in some of the poems where I feel almost intoxicated by you pile on these dreamlike sentences and the wordplay. You know, it's extremely rich. And I think a really nice one to finish might be the last poem in the book, which is actually Fuck You.
Yeah.
It would be lovely if you would read us that.
I'd be happy to. This is, one of the most cerebral but also fun poems to read and to write. This is it. Fuck you. My love, I promised, should you ever say you are not a body that has a soul, but a soul that has a body, and that body is within the soul, I'd respond, fuck you, and fuck out of here with that new age shit. But I haven't because early this week, crawling between the sheets, for an afternoon nap, I fell back expecting the goose feather pillow to gather my loose neck, but instead kept falling as if the feathers had parted into the smoothest clouds, then just forming snow, then hard rain, then red mist, then fire, raging fire, then molten stone, O boiling earth, O liquid metal, O solid thunder, O fire, all fury through which I kept tumbling, then all went silent, as if I'd falling off the cliff edge of quiet into space, all blue, all black, all blinking its many mooned and million mysteries, all of them ministering to me, and amongst them was I, drifting at the slowest speed possible, yet far above, out and wide as the planet's girth, all expanding, all still, all me, still there in that bed, moon-wrecked between its sheets, gasping and grasping at it. For all the fleshy sparkle of the body's glow, for all its muscular mystery, how could it contain all I had seen, all I had been, unless its reach is beyond itself, further than its bones allow, unless the soul is beyond its body, its edges blurring to brilliant madness.
That is fantastic. And you know what reminds me of Dante? I'm doing a course at the moment, and so I'm boring everyone with Dante's Divine Comedy. But, you know, towards the end of the Paradiso, he can't express, you know, what's happening. He's kind of, his soul has become one with the universe. There's just some beautiful language where he tries to express that whole position. It's sort of sublime, I suppose.
Oh, that's a high compliment. Thank you.
So what are you working on at the moment? You're a busy man.
I've sort of toned down and reduced the amount of things I'm working on. So at the moment, just one feature film that I'm writing, that's the main thing. And I have to start working on an essay, which is due in 10 days, which is about my childhood in Nigeria and eating meat. And that's it. It's called A Brief History of Suya, which is a dish that the Northern Nigerians, my father's mother's people, would make. And just that essay and this feature film I'm writing at the moment. The feature film takes a lot of brain power and a lot of research. It's set in the 80s in Nigeria. So those are the things I'm currently working on at the moment.
Sounds very exciting. Well, I hope one day to meet you and give you a firm handshake.
Thank you.
In real life.
I look forward to that.
All I can say is thanks ever so much, Inua, for coming on the show. And it's been brilliant.
No worries. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
So, wow. Inua Ellums, he is the real deal, isn't he? That is such a fluent and wonderful interview. And it just, as soon as I, you know, stopped listening to that, I just want to charge out and buy that book right away.
Yeah, he was excellent. A joy to talk with, really. His writing is just so beautiful as well.
There's such a breadth, you know, in terms of cultural reference, you know, you've got Perseus slicing up Medusa, and then you've got Biggie Smalls and Tupac, and the fact that he does screenwriting and plays and so on, you can really tell that, you know, like that the Fuck Carrots one where they're all in the barbershop.
Yeah.
You pulled out that thing about captains swaying in their seats, you know, all these guys. He sort of set up this idea that the people had, you know, migrated there or they were migrating to somewhere else. And it was just such an ensemble cinematic kind of vision that poem created.
I agree. And it's, as you said, there's levels of reference or that you go back to it again and again.
And I love what he does with this about, you know, boys and men growing up and mentioning the locker room talk of Trump and, you know, how men make other men and sort of handing down their really bad things. But nothing was three dimensional about it, you know, so you got the sense of men being fully rounded characters as well. There is a lot of writing where if a guy's in it, then they're just a cipher for all that's bad. I don't know. It's acknowledging where men have gone wrong, but it's also kind of full of vibrancy and life. And this idea of, you know, him starting off with this kind of thought of anger, and then he's sort of writing into what he says something about anger into a place where anger becomes more sincere, and that anger might be the motor, but what he's produced are these lyrical, beautiful, flowing, funny, well-rounded.
Yeah.
Such a great writer. I absolutely loved it.
Agreed. Very nuanced. I hope that book does really well.
Yeah. Despite the fact he wrote it on his phone as well, I barely able to text things, you know, and this idea that he's typing these masterworks into his phone.
Well, although to be fair, he did say he kind of put them down as a kind of stream of consciousness and then he edited them later. I don't think he was doing all the editing on the phone, you know, and all this in between, negotiating film scripts and stuff. I mean, he's just a powerhouse of creativity, inspiration.
Yeah. This thing of taking on the legacy of empire, you know, so this whole fuck Kipling business, you know, the white man's burden, that is an angry poem, but with absolute justification. And it is this thing, all these sort of people are, you know, that are dragging down statues in last year of slavers and things. And these things are out there. These are people literally on pedestals, you know, in this country.
Yeah.
I get really excited by the fact that he's taking that on, you know.
Also, that particular poem, he explained, didn't he, the personal connection, the fact that he personally had grown up with If and wanted to be that man in the poem. And then he was disappointed when he realised. So it's not like a rant or a general overall complaint, like, oh, this was really bad. It's actually, it's a personal story as well. And that really kind of really brings it home.
And that last poem, you were talking about how it piled on some dreamlike sentences. That was it called Just Fuck You?
Yeah.
And it was such a gorgeous, sublime poem, you know, sort of, he's sort of crawling into bed and putting his head on the pillow, but the pillow's not there. And then there was this flood of astonishingly beautiful imagery. It's almost like he was sinking into it. It felt to me like, my God, that's his talent. You know, he's just, he's, that guy's so talented that he's just floating on this cloud of brilliance. You know, it's, I absolutely adored that interview. And, I'm really buzzed about the idea of the fact that I've just ordered that on Amazon and I'm hoping it'll be here like in the next day or so.
If anyone's listening who's not convinced yet, it's from Penned in the Margins. Yeah, the production values are lovely. I always bang on about production values, but it is beautiful. And these end papers, which we touched on briefly at the end, I didn't say, oh, you designed them, didn't you? But afterwards I realised he has designed the end papers. He's also an artist as well as a writer.
Of course he is, yeah.
It's a bit sick making, isn't it, really?
Just more power to him. It's absolutely great.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're going to talk a bit now about a period of poetry that I'm not familiar with, but Peter, you're going to tell us a bit more about it, aren't you?
Going on from the wonderful interview you did earlier on, it was making me think of Negritude, which was a movement in Paris of black students. And the two leading lights of it were Léopold Sédar Senghor and Aimé Césaire. Together, they formed a magazine called The Étudiant Noir, pardon my French, or the Black Student. They were very influenced by surrealism. And what was liberating about surrealism was that instead of drawing on views of history and empire and so on, that it actually delved into people's subconscious to create images. And so it was something you could do for yourself. You could write poetry that was inflected with surrealism, that sort of came from you and not from a tradition which had previously excluded you. What I find fascinating about it is also this idea that exists in English poetry, that poetry makes nothing happen. Léopold Sédar Senghor went off to be the first president of Senegal, while Aimé Césaire became mayor of Fort-de-France in Martinique. And they were both went back to their own countries after studying in France and became, you know, immense figures. Césaire's book is extremely famous. The book is variously translated as Return to My Native Land or A Notebook of My Return to My Native Land. The language of the poem is sort of quite hip at the time and quite slangy. When it receives new translations, so some of them become quite bizarre.
So what period are we talking about here?
Yeah, I suppose I should have said about this before, really. So the magazine that Césaire and Senghor formed together was in 1934, but they really started this idea of negritude in the 30s. And actually, both of them died in the 21st century, but their main writing was, you know, in the 30s till maybe the 60s. There's a scrap of a poem by Césaire, which is really the thing that started negritude going. And negritude is a kind of term which just describes blackness, really, but it's like owned by black people. And he said, "My blackness is no stone, its deafness hurled against the clamour of the day. My blackness is no drop of dead water on the dead eye of the world. My blackness is neither a tower nor a cathedral. It thrusts into the red flesh of the earth. It thrusts into the burning flesh of the sky. It hollows out the dense despair from its own stone patience." The poet that I prefer out of these is Léopold Sédar Senghor. And one of my favourite poems of all time is called Night of Sine. Sine used to be a kingdom that was along a river in Senegal. And his Night of Sine poem goes like this in translation. "Woman, lay on my forehead your hands of balsam, your hands softer than fur. High above, the balancing palms hardly rustle in the high night wind, not even a cradle song. Let it rock us, the rhythmic silence. Listen to its song. Listen to the beating of our dark blood. Listen to the beating of the dark pulse of Africa in the haze of forgotten villages. See how the tired moon slips to its bed of slack water. See how the laughter drowses, how the tellers themselves nod their heads like babies on the backs of their mothers. See how the feet of the dancers grow heavy and heavy the tongues of alternate choirs. This is the hour of stars and the night that dreams, leaning on this hill of clouds, draped in her long milk gown. The thatch of the huts gleams gently, but what does it say so secretly to the stars? Inside, the hearth grows dim in close, bitter and sweet smells. Woman, light the lamp of clear oil. Let the ancestors gather and speak like parents when the children have gone to bed. Listen to the voice of the ancients of Elissa. Like us, exiled, they feared to die, to lose their seminal flood in the sand. Let me listen in the smoking hut to the murmur of favourable souls come down. My head on your breast, like a couscous ball smoking from fire. Let me breathe the smell of our dead. Let me gather and tell their life force. Let me learn to live before going down, deeper than the diver, into tall fathoms of sleep." That's just one of my favourite poems of all time. I love it many reasons. At that point in black writing, for black people to actually talk about their own experience and not be portrayed through other people's eyes was actually quite a revolutionary act. So both those poets, if you're not familiar with them, Aimé Césaire and Léopold Sédar Senghor, just find out about their stories and read their books because they're crackers.
The names will be in the description for the podcast as well, can't we? So people can look them out. That's powerful stuff.
I went to Chad in Central Africa a few years ago, and I spent some time inside a mud hut. That sort of earthy smell of being in that kind of womb-like, very homely place. You know, I was instantly thinking of that poem when I was there. Interesting poet and, you know, a shaper of his nation as well.
Through the poem, there's that sense of being in exile and homesickness, and sort of goes back a bit to some of the things that we were saying about Inua's poems, like the carrots poem and people at a kind of a crossroads, and also what he was speaking about, the British army going in and destroying Benin City and all that was there, as if it were a load of mud huts in their mind, but they couldn't see beyond some sort of primitive society, when in fact it was a highly sophisticated,
yeah,
hugely long-standing society that it just the pure ignorance of just destroying stuff. Peter, are there any words that you avoid in poems for whatever reason, or that you perhaps that you spot in other people's poems, you just think, ah, that word?
I'm not really very good at policing other people's work, but or don't feel that it should happen. But
just in asking my own, for an opinion.
Yeah, but there's always one word that springs to mind, which is tendril. There was a time when I'd just be reading my poetry magazines and every fourth poem had the word tendril in. I think, how many times does tendril come into your world? Actually, it's kind of like bad habits in your own writing.
Yes.
I used to read loads of W.B. Yeats when I first started falling in love with poetry and writing. And the word some kind of...
Oh, yeah. Like some as in something or...
Just the word some.
Yeah.
I seem to use it in a kind of flamboyant Yeats-ish kind of rhetorical way. You know, you just have to take it out and have a word with yourself.
I'm definitely guilty of something. I use the word something sometimes.
Yeah.
It's like, really? Something? Come on. I remember a while back taking a poem to a workshopping group and it had the word shard in it. And I was practically told, forget about shard, just don't use shard. This was the first time I'd heard such a thing.
Yeah.
That certain words one shouldn't put into poems. There is this kind of, this mythical banned word list. And and as soon as you ask people what they think of these banned words, there'll be some who say, oh yeah, shard, tendril, myriad, cumulus, outpours this list of words.
Yeah.
But they're all words that one does see in poems every now and again, doesn't one?
Oh God, yeah. Nothing can be black, it has to be obsidian. Stuff like that, yeah. But obsidian is such an interesting word, you know.
It depends on the actual, what you're talking about, what the rest of the poem, the language you're using generally, doesn't it? If you're using all kind of Anglo-Saxon monosyllabic words and you throw in tesserae or obsidian,
yeah,
then it's just going to grate. So there is that, of course.
I once drove myself mad writing a play which was based on Anglo-Saxon poem. But I was trying to make the words that are used in the play to be Anglo-Saxon. And so once you start thinking about that and like start omitting Latin-based words and all the rest of it, it's a fast track to madness. I'm reluctant to police other people's work, like I said, but I do think there are fashions in poetry. And certainly when you're reading lots of magazines, everybody's reading each other in these magazines and certain words, bad habits are passed on virally.
Yeah.
And I think I haven't done this, but I suspect that if you picked up a couple of magazines from, you know, 10, 15 years ago and looked at them, there would be little buzzwords in there that kind of seem, you know, really moribund now.
That's probably true. Yeah, that's probably true. Anyway, I think the general feeling is that there's no definitively banned words, are there? That's a bit silly, isn't it? But just have an ear out to something that seems inappropriate in its context, I guess.
Yeah, because even things that, you know, seem tired, give them another 5 or 10 years, so they're all sort of reborn again.
Well, that's fine, because that's how long it takes to get a poem into a magazine. Also what you said about your own repetition, and just, I notice this if I'm laying out a load of poems thinking, hey, maybe I've got a pamphlet or a collection, ha-ha, and I look quickly from one to another, I start to see there are words that I've overused.
Mm.
And that's probably when I have to rethink that word. I think, have I got a thing about that word? I need to just drop it completely for a while.
Yeah.
Otherwise it'll just keep creeping in.
I notice when I write prose that my absolute fault, and I even have a program now that I use, is to use the same word 10 or 15 times in a chapter. So if I'm talking about a restaurant, the word restaurant will crop up. What I do now is just copy a chunk of prose and put it in this on this website. And it tells you, oh, look, you've used the word restaurant 12 times in 2,000 words. And then you go back and it forces you to add a bit of variety to the mix, you know.
It's easy to spot when someone's tried not to use the same word, isn't it? So,
oh, that's
so
even
worse, yeah. He went to the restaurant, and then the eating establishment was like the pizza place. Yeah, that's quite funny. There's one word that I came across in this Dante translation the other day, which was scintillate, and I just couldn't accept it. I thought, I cannot have that word in this translation, because it always makes me think of that Roger McGough. Is it Roger McGough, the one about, you know, I used to scintillate, now I only sin till 10 past three or something like that. So whenever I do scintillate, I can't have it, especially if it's a serious poem.